I'm part of this, excuse my voice, a little raspy because I've been talking with people nonstop. The ACT, a Pray, ACT, Vote, Educate, I'm on the educate side. We're going to learn something very important about the truth. The title of the talk is The Deepest Cultural Divide That Defines the Pro-Life Struggle, The Christian and the Epicurean Revised. Now you have my wife of 35 years to thank for this topic. Whoa. I asked her, well, dear, what should I talk about at the Cleveland Pro-Life Conference? And her reply was, well, how about the Christian and the Epicurean? Given that she has a tremendously good sixth sense about these things, I took her advice. Now, interestingly enough, it's almost 20 years ago that I wrote an article called The Christian and the Epicurean, and many books and articles later, I'm even more deeply convinced that understanding the two distinct ways of trying to understand God, the universe, human nature, and human morality is one of the great keys to grasping the deepest cultural divide that defines the pro-life struggle. So I've been thinking about this, reading about it, writing about it for now for two decades. So you're not going to get just me reading a 20-year-old article. This is revised, that is, from two decades of work. Now, at its most basic level in boiled down form, the argument I'm making is this. The pro-life struggle is not primarily about the legal decision of Roe v. Wade. The infamous court case is really just one of the many effects of a much larger, far more comprehensive cultural divide between people who hold two rival and incompatible views of reality, the Christian and the Epicurean materialist. Now, allow me to give a brief sketch of the two views, which have different arguments about what is true. That is, they really are arguing that there are two different ways of seeing things. So you'll see deeply their incompatibility and get a glimpse of what that means in regard to the pro-life struggle. Now, I want you to understand that this is not an abstract intellectual exercise we're going through. About 600 years ago, the materialist philosophy of the ancient pagan Greek philosopher Epicurus re-entered the mainstream of civilization and spread all throughout Europe, and thus Epicurean materialism has come to saturate nearly every aspect of our culture, our way of life, our way of thinking, our view of morality and law, our view of science, our view of rationality, indeed our view of reality. As I've read deeply and widely in the history of science and of philosophy, of politics and ethics and popular culture since the 1400s, I keep finding the footprints of Epicurus all over, or more accurately, the footprints of those who are following him. Now, 600 years is a long time to have that kind of influence, and you understand, of course, that six centuries ago when this Epicurean materialism entered Western civilization, it was a Christianized civilization, one that was based on the assumption that human beings were a unique animal, that is, the one creature on earth made in the image of God, the singular moral creature. Since then, that is, since 600 years ago, note that Christianity has been slowly displaced and replaced over the centuries by a rival view, Epicurean materialism, so that now in the West, we live in a society which is actually a mixture of Christians and Epicureans, and the entirely different, indeed opposite ways of understanding everything that flow from these differences are the ultimate causes of the pro-life battles. So I had to set this up, and when I do an illustration of it, you'll see it vividly what I'm talking about. Now, I think most of you are well aware what Christianity is, but you may not understand what Epicureanism is. That is, you may have heard of the word Epicurean, but you don't know who the philosopher was behind it. Epicurus was an ancient Greek pagan philosopher who lived from 341 to 270 B.C. That is, he's three centuries before the birth of Christ. Now, Epicurus thought that the main evil plaguing human beings was the fear of the gods. Now, he's saying this in context of the Greek gods. The fear of the gods, that is how they might punish us in this life, zapping us with lightning if we didn't do some kind of a thing that they wanted, or harassing us in Hades in the next life. For Epicurus, all that was the most significant source of our misery in this life. Not only that, Epicurus argued, religion itself makes people do evil things, like sacrificing one of their daughters to placate the gods, or getting in fights with other people who have other gods, just based on the fact that they have different religions. So Epicurus, thinking that the gods were the source, the belief in gods were the source of all evil, argued that we have to get rid of the gods. We have to get rid of the gods. So what did he do? Now here's where you're going to understand why I'm choosing Epicurus. Listen carefully to his cure for what ails us, the gods. Epicurus quite literally designed a cosmos, a universe into which the gods could not possibly fit. And human beings would therefore have nothing to fear at all. He argued that there are only two things in the universe, material atoms and the space between them. There are no immaterial beings, hence there are no gods. But if there are no gods, then how did the world and everything in it get here? Epicurus had an answer. In the universe designed by Epicurus, no eternal creating gods are necessary because the atoms themselves are eternal. And by their banging around in an infinite space and during infinite time, the atoms accidentally create all possible worlds and life forms within them. Okay, that should sound a little familiar. And he's saying this in the 3rd century B.C. What about human beings? Well, according to Epicurus, human beings are just one more thing created by the random jostling of the atoms. Since, like everything else, human beings are made only of material atoms, they do not have souls. So they don't have immaterial souls, they're just bodies. And because they are just bodies, when they die, they have nothing to fear from death. Their atoms dissipate, and that's it. So you're doubly released from the plague of the gods, right? First of all, there are no gods. Second of all, when you die, you just turn into chemical mush, right? You're just atoms. So there's nothing to fear. You're relieved of another burden as well by this kind of materialism because you don't have to worry anymore about morality. There is no morality. They're just atoms moving. Okay, and in regard to your being simply a bodily creature, morality is simple. Good means something causes you physical pleasure, and evil means something causes you physical pain. And since people are pained and pleased by different things, then morality is, strictly speaking, entirely subjective and relative. It just has to do with whether you like fish patties or abortion. You know, it's all a matter of taste. Right, there's not really any foundation for it. Now let's compare. Whoa, and I knew Epicurus would show up. He hates when I do this. Okay. Back off, Epicurus. Okay, now let's compare these two views of reality. In the Christian understanding of reality, a loving, wise creator exists, and we human beings are made in the image of that creator, God. In the Epicurean materialist view, there is no God, there is only matter, that is, material atoms swirling around in the void of space. Human beings are just one more unintended accident of the random, endless, and purposeless interactions of brute matter. In the Christian understanding, human beings are creatures of body and immaterial soul, made in the image of God. And so, unlike other animals, human beings have an eternal destiny after this life, one in which they will be judged for how they live in this life. In the Epicurean materialist view, all is matter. Therefore, human beings are creatures of body alone. So they are not fundamentally distinct from other animals. This is a key concept. They're not fundamentally distinct from other animals, and they have no existence and hence no judgment awaiting them after death. When they die, they are dead, just like a cat or a dog. Okay, now we can get to the payoff intellectually that will make you understand why this is important for the pro-life struggles. Imagine that you have a society in which, say, half the people are Christian and half the people are Epicurean. They have completely different views about human nature, the universe, God, the whole thing. Imagine further that you drop into them, as like we're a testing tank, a single moral issue. And let's use euthanasia as an illustration. How will the two different arguments, views, see the same issue? Now, you'll soon see why everything depends on which of the two is true and which is false. For the Epicurean, euthanasia is in fact not a moral issue, for the very same reason that taking your very old decrepit dog to the vet to have it put down is not a moral issue, at least in the way that a Christian thinks it is. Because your dog only has one life to live, its physical existence in this world, then having your dog euthanized because it is old, decrepit, and suffering is humane. On this, the Christian and the Epicurean agree. But for the Epicurean materialist, human beings and dogs do not differ in kind. They are both animals, both creatures of body alone, equally with the result of millions of years of the random couplings of matter. Therefore, euthanizing old, decrepit, and suffering human beings is equally humane. Okay, you have to enter their world to understand, oh, that's why you say that. Indeed, in the Epicurean view, someone who fails to put down a favorite pet or person who is suffering physically is failing morally. He is inhumane, more concerned about his own emotional pain than the real physical pain of the suffering dog or the suffering human being. In the Epicurean world, then, someone who protests against human euthanasia and tries to stop it would be just as irrational and pernicious as someone who would protest outside a veterinary clinic and would try to push through legislation against euthanizing animals. Both cause senseless and inhumane suffering within their worldview. Now, I'm sure you already see the painful point, but I'll say it anyway to make certain that you understand the full ramifications. The Epicurean materialist doesn't secretly believe that he is doing something immoral in supporting euthanasia. He deeply and openly believes that the Christian is doing something inhumane and hence immoral in opposing euthanasia. Moreover, the Christian opposition to euthanasia for the Epicurean is based upon a belief in a particular God, but in the materialist world, gods do not exist. And so being told that the God of the Bible forbids euthanasia is, for the Epicurean materialist, the equivalent of telling him that Zeus in the Iliad opposes euthanasia. Now, the Christian, on the other hand, opposes euthanasia for human beings for the very same reason that he supports it for animals. A human being isn't just any animal, but a unique animal of body and immortal, immaterial soul, the only animal made in the image of God the Creator. That difference makes all the difference because it defines the essential moral difference undergirding all morality. All Christian moral prohibitions are rooted in one essential truth, that human beings are not just another animal. And as soon as you take away this essential truth, the whole moral edifice of Christianity collapses immediately. It has no foundation. Now, that's how the Epicurean looks at it. It doesn't have a foundation. Now, note carefully. The Christian does indeed support the fundamental distinction between human beings and animals by appealing to the Bible, specifically Genesis. But he also appeals to our common sense, everyday realization that human beings have astoundingly complex languages, produce excruciatingly subtle and intricate mathematical systems, build machines that can fly, and so on and on. In short, human beings express intellectual abilities so far beyond any of the other animals that there is no comparison by degree, but a huge chasm that separates human beings from the most intelligent animal. This great qualitative difference, which would appear so evident, supports the moral difference, the one rooted in the fact that we are not just another animal, but something quite unique. And it's no accident that the Epicurean materialist does everything he can to close the gap between humans and animals. Okay, so that's why there's that kind of literally the PBS approach to how you treat animals. Now think deeply on this. If there is no essential qualitative difference between a human being and any other animal, if that is the truth, then all prohibitions against murder of whatever kind are entirely without foundation, unless we want to prohibit the killing of any and all creatures. The very term murder, this is going to kind of hurt, so prepare yourself. The very term murder, as distinct from killing, assumes not just that the life taken is innocent. After all, who only eats morally reprehensible chickens or cows and allows the innocent cows to flourish? Okay? The term murder doesn't have to do with innocence. It's on the deepest level rooted in the distinction between human and non-human life. That's the only reason to use the term. So for a Christian, holding the line against euthanasia is not about a single moral issue. It is about the protection of morality itself by maintaining the essential distinction between animals which we can euthanize and human beings whom we should not. Now, in the case of euthanasia, you can see, I hope, how deep this divide is between the Christian and the Epicurean. And the question is, what is true? Molly's been saying, pay attention to what is true. Now, notice how difficult this makes it. The very same act, you say, well, what is true? What's going on here? The very same act, injecting a lethal dosage of a drug into an old woman with Parkinson's disease, is seen by the Epicurean as morally humane, and by the Christian as attacking the very foundation of morality itself. You can't just appeal to the event because there's a complete disagreement about what is actually happening. Now, I know that you could easily guess what would happen if you dropped down another moral issue into our Epicurean and Christian imaginary fish tank, we could call it our example. If you drop down abortion into a society composed of Christians and Epicureans, you're going to get the same thing. For the Epicurean materialist, a human being is merely a material being, no different than any other animal. Protesting outside an abortion clinic would therefore be as strange and pernicious as protesting outside a veterinary clinic, because abortions are regularly performed there as well. But Christians do not protest outside veterinary clinics, and they do protest outside of Planned Parenthood, precisely because the difference between an animal and a human being is the essential moral difference. It is the one that is the foundation of all of them. So again, in fighting against abortion, think about this. You're not just fighting against abortion. You are fighting for all of morality, because it rests on that fundamental distinction. If you give up that distinction, that's the end of all morality, not just one issue, abortion. And here again, the very same act, a woman getting abortion, is seen by the Epicurean and the Christian in entirely different, rival, incompatible ways. For the Epicurean, the abortion of human beings is no more morally charged than the abortion of dogs, cats, or rabbits. If it reduces the suffering of the woman, then it is even humane, just as it would be if it reduced the suffering of an animal taken to the vet. For the Christian, on the other hand, the very same act, abortion, is murder, but it is murder only because human beings are fundamentally distinct from other animals. Again, the fundamental difference is not between innocent or guilty life, but between human and non-human life. So everything depends on what is true about the distinction between human beings and other animals. Now, for some time now, you've realized this isn't an imaginary exercise, of course, because these two rival views actually deeply divide our society. It's as if we're living next door to people, but we don't share the same universe. We have entirely different views of reality. So we don't have a mere legal disagreement about Roe v. Wade and how it was decided. We have a disagreement about reality, about truth, about what a human being is. Roe v. Wade is a symptom, an effect of this deepest of all possible disagreements about reality itself. Now, this is difficult news for the pro-life movement. Why do I know? Because I teach at Franciscan University, and that's a hotbed of pro-life activity, and I'm the director of human life studies there, which is a minor. It's very difficult for me to deliver this news to my students in human life studies because they really want to believe that all would be well if they could just overturn Roe v. Wade. They really want to believe that's all that's necessary. But they soon see that the other side just doesn't disagree about abortion. They disagree about the nature of reality, about what a human being is, about what nature is, about the existence of God. Abortion is murder if and only if a human being is qualitatively distinct from other animals. But if a human being is no different than any other mammal developing in the womb, then abortion of a human being is no different than abortion of any other animal, and hence not morally wrong. Or to put it another way, the biggest, deepest disagreements about reality between the Christian and the Epicurean, the big picture. I call it the cosmological picture for my students. The big picture, the deepest disagreements are the cause of a multitude of cultural battles that we experience. One subset of which, we can call this the smaller picture, is composed of those issues directly addressed to the pro-life movement. That is, what you've got is two rival views creating entirely different intellectual, moral, political, social cultures. Okay, it's the entire big thing, and abortion is one aspect of it. Now, let me illustrate how comprehensive this struggle is. Almost every aspect of modern biology is defined by what is called a reductionist approach to life. By reductionist, we mean that however complicated any living thing appears to be, including human beings, its complexity in both form and activity can be reduced to the order of the chemical constituents of its DNA. This DNA is in turn the result of millions of years of blind evolution, where particular random mutations prove to be beneficial under particular circumstances for particular organisms. Human DNA is no exception, and so the human organism is likewise just the same as any other organism. It is a particular material composite of atoms, or a mass of cells, we might say, that has resulted from random mutations that happen to prove beneficial. Now, that is the assumed view in nearly every respected high school and college biology textbook. As you should now see, this reductionist view in biology is a very complex and sophisticated form of Epicurean materialism. A little reflection also allows us to understand that this sophisticated reductionist view of biology supports a reductionist view of human beings as one more biological entity, a view that sees the developing human being in the womb as fundamentally indistinct from any other developing mammal in the womb, so that it makes sense to characterize this developing human being as merely a mass of cells. Therefore, the reductionist view of biology, which defines reality for biology, and we're part of biology, at least indirectly supports the affirmation of abortion. Now, note that I am not saying that every biologist supports abortion, because that is happily not the case. I'm saying something more difficult to grasp, and this is one of the reasons that human life studies and in other courses I teach the history of science. I am saying something more difficult to grasp, and even more difficult to fix, that modern biology as a science has developed historically according to the materialist assumptions of Epicureanism. that the creation of life has no need of a divine explanation, that a human being is not qualitatively distinct from other living creatures, that the form and activity of anything, including human beings, is reducible to its atomic parts. Historically in the West, the philosophical assumptions of Epicureanism were introduced and accepted several centuries before the development of modern reductionist biology, and hence helped define that movement. Now, here's the point that nobody wants to hear, at least of all my students in human life studies at Franciscan. You can't fix the little picture without fixing the big picture. So I tell my students, if you want to help out in the pro-life cause, one place you might want to go is into biology. Study it in depth so that you become a world-class biologist. That is, you have everyone's respect. And while you're doing that, test the assumptions of the reductionist, the reigning reductionist view of biology, and in particular, test the assumption that a living human being can be reduced to just one more organized mass of cells, and that in turn these cells can be reduced to their constituent chemical elements. A decent start on non-reductionist scientific approach to the study of living things has been made among what is called the emergentist approach to biology from emerging. That's too complicated to get into. I won't do it now. So it isn't as if there hasn't been a significant start on it. You don't have to start from scratch. So notice, big picture, this is how we understand biology, little picture. Well, if that's the reality of biology, then abortion is not a moral issue. Now I'm going to take another example, this one from philosophy. You can pick almost any discipline. We even can do mathematics, believe it or not, and look at this. But we're not going to do that. We're going to do philosophy now. Let's take another example. There is a large-scale disagreement about the nature and purpose of sexuality today, which runs down the exact divide between the Christian and the Epicurean. This is a big-picture disagreement. The real father of the modern sexual revolution is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau lived from 1712 to 1778, and there are a few people that have done that much damage. It's immensely influential. Directly against Christianity, Rousseau argued that by nature, human beings are just one more kind of animal. According to Rousseau, man in his original natural condition was a solitary animal moved entirely by his appetites. When he was hungry, he ate. When he was sleepy, he napped. And when he felt a sexual urge, he satisfied it at the first available opportunity and then wandered off. He had no religion and no morality and no desire for society. All those are not part of human nature. The natural sexual act for this original man, according to Rousseau, in his famous words, the sexual act is merely the result of a blind inclination devoid of any sentiment of the heart, and hence only a purely animal act. Once the desire was fulfilled, the participants wandered away with no notion of attachment. For Rousseau, this was an argument that marriage was unnatural, something that developed later on and ruined our original human-animal sexual freedom, and hence ruined our real natural happiness. The only way to recapture this original happiness that's been lost, argued Rousseau, was to free sexuality from the artificial chains of marriage and also of Christian morality, and allow human desire to follow its whims as it first had, and according to his scheme. Now, it doesn't take much reflection to see that Rousseau's view of human sexuality would lead, if acted upon, and Rousseau himself acted upon it, believe me, if acted upon, would lead to the necessity of contraception and abortion. Rousseau was one of the most influential thinkers in modernity, and so as a matter of fact, that is, you can actually trace it in the history of ideas and down through the laws, as a matter of fact, the acceptance of his ideas did lead to the acceptance of abortion. We can actually trace the development from the appearance of Rousseau's second discourse, that is, the Discourse on the Origin and Foundation of Inequality Among Men. It was published in 1754. We can trace the development from that book, published in 1754, through the sexual revolution and right down to Roe v. Wade in 1973. And that's an important thing to know. Where did it come from? But again, here's the point you don't want to hear, and again, neither do my students in human life studies. Rousseau was an immensely influential philosopher, writing about everything from psychology and the arts to education and political philosophy. He's a big picture philosopher, one of the biggest and most influential in modern history for defining our culture today. One part of that big picture leads to the sexual revolution, and a part of that part leads to abortion. But that means that we cannot remove one of the undesirable effects, abortion, without systematically overturning his entire philosophy. And that's no small task because it's so deeply embedded in our culture. So I tell my students, if you want to stop abortion, show how Rousseau's big picture philosophy was systematically wrong. And then you have to transform society from the error to the truth. Not a small task. It's been gone for three centuries at least. It's done a lot of damage. Now, I want to note something about Rousseau that's interesting for the thesis about the Christian and the Epicurean. Almost everything that you find in Rousseau, now he lived in the 18th century, you can find in the Roman pagan philosopher Lucretius. Almost everything. If he were my student, I would have charged him with plagiarism. That's how close it is. Lucretius is a Roman pagan disciple of Epicurus. Okay? So it goes Epicurus, Lucretius, Rousseau. So there he is popping up again, Lucretius waving to, or Epicurus waving to us. Rousseau's revolution, his philosophical revolution, rests on the Epicurean philosopher Lucretius. And that means our sexual revolution was and is actually an Epicurean revolution. But as long as we're defined by the notion that freedom from sexual restraint is unnatural, the sexually liberated will demand abortion. Therefore, we must shake free of Rousseau to win the pro-life cause. The big picture must change, or the small picture will remain the same. Now, let me offer one more angle. And then I'm going to throw in a few other ones at the end. But one more angle on how big the big picture is and how the big picture and the little picture are related. There is actually, historically, only one reason why there is even such a thing as a pro-life struggle. And by the way, what I'm about to tell you, historically, anyone, doesn't matter whether you're an atheist, a Christian, a Hindu, indifferent, this is simply an historical analysis. There's only one reason why there is such a thing as a pro-life struggle, or even more pointed, why there was Roe v. Wade. The enforced legalization of abortion only came about because abortion was illegal. Right? But why was it illegal? You know, because for most of history, it's not been illegal. Historically, there's only one source for abortion being illegal in the West, and that is Christianity. That is, you can prove this historically. If you remove Christianity from history, abortion would never have been made illegal. As a matter of historical fact, abortion was widespread in the pagan Roman Empire and the Greek Empire as well. Egypt, wherever you go, abortion was widespread. They did it by chemicals. Okay, they would take all kinds of poisons, and I won't list all the weird poisons they took. But they didn't distinguish between contraception and abortion. It was to take the poison, get rid of the baby. Okay, so you remove Christianity from history, and abortion would not have been made. An abortion would never have been made illegal. So we find in the Roman Empire, abortion was quite commonplace and accepted. Christianity was born into that pagan Roman Empire, as we find out from the Didache. The first century AD catechetical manual for pagan converts, as this is the first Christian catechesis, is the Didache. Abortion is explicitly forbidden to pagan converts. They have to tell the pagan converts, oh, by the way, you can't get an abortion. It's also, by the way, you can't have sex with little boys. By the way, you can't. There's a whole list of things, and abortion is one of them. Contraception, interestingly enough, is another one. So the only reason that abortion became illegal was that Christians evangelized the Roman Empire with the big picture of Christianity. The whole message about a loving God creating the world, human beings being made in the image of God, of the fall and need of redemption, of the incarnation, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. The prohibition of abortion was one part of that big evangelical picture about reality. This is what reality is, okay? That's what Christianity is actually teaching. It's an argument about reality. And as Christianity came to dominate in Europe, laws against abortion began to appear historically. That's where they came from. By the way, that's when pornography started to disappear as well. Pornography was widespread in the Roman Empire. We don't know that, but it's true. If there had been no Christianity, there would have been no laws against abortion for Roe v. Wade to overturn. Now, interestingly enough, when Epicureanism made its reappearance in the West in the 1400s and 1500s, its devotees believed that Christianity was a big picture mistake, one of the biggest, and that for the sake of our true happiness of humanity in this world, Christianity must be removed root and branch. And so they set about destroying the big Christian picture. This is in the 1400s and 1500s, by the way. You may not know, but modern atheism actually begins in the 1400s and 1500s. It isn't the 1980s or 90s. You trace it all the way back. They pick up ancient pagan atheists and they start saying, well, this is true. So what they're arguing is we need to remove the big Christian picture. So the advance of modern secularism, that is, of the modern de-Christianization of culture, is the result of the increasing success of this Epicurean project. And it is no accident, then, as the big Christian picture has been scratched out, stamped out, or politely ushered off the historical stage, one of the results, just one, has been the return of abortion. But if you understand the big historical picture, it's inevitable. You could have predicted it. Remove Christianity, and the moral pieces that flow from its central doctrines will disappear with it. That's what you're experiencing. But what does that mean, I ask my students, other than that Christians must re-evangelize what has been de-evangelized by the Epicurean materialists? We need to tell the whole big truth about Christianity if we want the smaller truth that abortion is murder to be overturned. Now, there are a whole, I'm looking at the clock and saying, okay, I can throw a few of these in, but not much. What you, I hope, can see from this kind of analysis is we have some serious intellectual work to be done, as well as the on-the-front-line stuff to be done. And one of my jobs is, I'm not on the front line, I'm in trying to figure out what is the big picture so that we can pray, act, vote, and we need to educate as well. So the Human Life Studies program at Franciscan is made to do that, get them to understand how it is that we went bad and how it permeates every aspect of our culture. So let me throw in a few more just really quick, and then we'll go to questions. The belief that you say, if you say moral relativism is a bad thing, it was actually a person called Thomas Hobbes who lived in the who published his most famous work in 1651, who is the father of modern moral relativism. And his argument is very simple. The world is made of atoms. Atoms are neither good or bad. They just fly around. If you don't like a position of atoms that hits you, you say it's evil, but it's just a bunch of atoms. If you like it, then it causes you pleasure and you say it's good, but it's just a bunch of atoms. So good and evil, in his words, are ever used in relationship to the person that uses them. In your terminology, they're merely subjective. It's just that you like the way something is, so you call it good. But there's ultimately no good and evil, when he very clearly states this in his arguments. There is no good or evil by nature, period. Okay? And where does it come from? It comes, it's a projection of each human being, so we all differ, and it differs during time. Guess who was just like one of the model Epicureans? He took Epicurus almost verbatim off the pages as Thomas Hobbes. Okay? It's Thomas Hobbes. I mean, that's what he was. He's also the founder of modern natural rights. I know y'all get very displeased when you say talk about the right to the unborn and then they bounce back with the right of the woman. That's Thomas Hobbes haunting you. That's Thomas Hobbes, because all Hobbes did was say, you know what? There's no right or wrong at all. Okay? There's no good or evil. So people have particular desires, and we're just going to call them rights from now on. He literally invented the term rights for it, so that I have a right to really only means I have a desire for. And that's why in battles, whether it's about gay marriage, abortion, whatever, just think about how many times people say I have a right to something. All it means is I have a desire for it. It doesn't mean anything more. It's got no moral substance. That's why you can never win an argument based on that notion of rights. Well, thank an Epicurean, okay, if you want to. That's Thomas Hobbes. And if I do, I do a show for EW2 and Saints versus Scoundrels, and next fall we'll be showing our G.K. Chesterton versus Thomas Hobbes. It's going to be fun. It's a good fun. Okay, that's a little off topic, but utilitarian ethics. In the pro-life movement, we don't like utilitarian ethics. It's bad because it reduces pleasure to meaning good for you and pain to evil, and that means if somebody doesn't like something, it's evil, and therefore you should stop the evil. So if they have a pregnancy and it causes them distress, then you should stop the pregnancy. That's utilitarian ethics. Guess who the founders of modern utilitarian ethics are? Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, both professed card-carrying Epicureans. This is one after another. I'm almost tempted to usher. Okay, I'll do this. I was talking with someone earlier. I can't touch this. I can't. He gave me his card. I'm sorry. Forgive me. But we talked about how it is you can connect the history of mathematics. You say you can't do that to the pro-life cause. You actually can. Watch this. With Descartes, Rene Descartes, the I think, therefore I am guy, he believed that mathematics was the key to understanding reality, and in fact it trumped it, and that mathematics was a humanly contrived type of rationality, and the world itself wasn't rational. Therefore, he shifts the location of truth from outside to the truth-constructing human being. Okay, it's one of the most important fundamental shifts in philosophy. That's actually the whole background of his famous thing, I think, therefore I am. You've heard that, come on. Everyone think, I think, therefore I am. It's a joke for Descartes. Some people usually don't catch this. It's a joke for Descartes because he's purposely moving the location of truth from outside himself to inside himself, and he believes that mathematics is a purely human construction, and that mathematics is the very foundation of the only rationality there is, an artificially constructed human rationality, right? So it's the source of all intellectual truth. So it takes the place of God. Okay, now, what's the name of God in the Old Testament? I think, therefore I am. Okay, it was what we call in the business ingenious blasphemy of the first order. And if people quote that all the time, that's what it's doing. And so you have the shift saying nature is not intelligible itself. It is only human beings that put order into it. That's the big shift. You say, and it matters then how you understand what mathematics is. So there's a whole lot of connections like that. And in the human life studies, we examine a lot of those so that students can see how pervasive the big picture is. And the good news for them, as I say, it almost doesn't matter what discipline you're in. You can work for the pro-life cause. Because they have this notion, well, you know, I really wanted to go in biology, but you know, I just, there's babies being aborted. Okay, get into biology and do it quickly. There's so many areas that you can go into. Now, what I want to do now is I want to leave enough time for questions. So that's all I'm going to say, although if you were in one of my classes, you realize that I could say a lot more and it would take you long to escape, but I thank you for your attention.
wow, is your mind blown? Amazing, as I said. Dr. Benjamin Weicker is probably the best mind in America, if not in the world, on these types of issues. We are so fortunate to have him here with us today. So, again, thank you so much, Benjamin. And we will have you on the radio program, too, because I'm not going to get through this big wad of questions.
Oh, no, that's
questions.
Fine. No, so, I can stay over here so I'm not beeping.
All right. So here we're going to – the first one is please give us a give us two minutes on Emergist biology.
Emergentist,
whatever, yes. However you say that, biology.
Yeah, the notion is that things of a lower order are actually I'll do it backwards. You can't reduce things of a higher order of organization to something of a lower order. That is, when things combine on the chemical level, they take on properties that aren't predictable from the original level. The easiest one to understand is hydrogen and oxygen. If you just had hydrogen and oxygen and you wrote out all the properties you could get from them independently, you couldn't predict all the weird properties of water. Okay, so when you have a larger whole, it's not reducible to the lower one. And in biology, the argument is like this. You can't reduce an animal to its DNA because the animal's actual active life is the original place that you have to begin to understand what it is and how it acts. And so you actually deform your understanding of the animal if you don't study animals in the wild. And this is a really crazy thing to say, but there's a backlash in biology because the number of biologists who used to go out and look at critters in the wild has been reduced to almost nothing. Most of them are in laboratories in front of computers. They actually don't know that much about the actual animal they're studying. And a sign of this is that the ones that do will go to them, talk to them, and see that the difference between their computer models that they're manipulating and the activity of the actual animal shows that they don't understand the thing that they believe is there. So there's a backlash about trying to reclaim what was used to be called natural history, which literally means if you're going to study bugs, study the bugs. Don't study the computer thing. If you're going to study rabbits, okay? So all it's telling you is that no higher order can be reduced to a lower order, even though it contains the constituent elements of it. There's got a whole lot of other implications in chemistry, by the way, but my 2 minutes is up.
Good. I like to see somebody who stays on time. Okay, why are so many, and we're going to switch places, otherwise when we do the YouTube thing and people want to go back and watch, they're going to watch me, and they don't want to see me, they want to see you. So we're going to push this down, and you're going to come back.
Okay, here I go.
Okay, go on that side, there we go.
All right.
Why are so many modernists simply and often violently incapable of even tolerating our position on life?
Well, especially if you bring in the big picture, once you say, I'll put it this way, maybe this is the most succinct way, I want to do this activity, whatever it is, or I've already done it, say it's to get an abortion. What I want is for the universe to support it. Okay, so there's what's called rationalization, which means you reform reality in accordance with the acts that you have, you either want to achieve or want to exonerate. So notice if you, and this is, I'm trying to be pastoral here. Someone who got an abortion, in one very weird way, it would be a relief to know there's no God. Okay, it would be a relief to know that that just was a mass of cells. So in a way, Epicureanism has a kind of hold because it releases you from any deep moral tensions that you might have. And that makes it self-perpetuating because the worse the culture of death gets, the more acts are going to engage in. And hence, the more nobody wants to live in a universe that condemns them. So you go, like Epicurus, you get another universe. If you don't like that one, try this one on.
The next one is, isn't the modernist curriculum, the modernist high school curriculum, just producing a new autonomous new Epicureans? What is a parent to do?
Scream and run into the woods. I say this as having seven children. You can't not recapture education. And I mean this in the deepest sense. That's why I use the word biology, and everybody's going to be mad at me, and so I'll create a diversion and run out the door. You can't just take biology and add Jesus on top, as some textbooks do. That's not how the problem is. Okay? The problem is that we have a deeply embedded reductionist view of biology that you have to address on every level. That's why I say first become the world-class biologist so that people will listen to you. So the difficulty is that you don't have a way to educate in many of the areas because they haven't been reclaimed intellectually, or insufficiently. Okay, so that makes it a problem. You know, some things are fine. Maybe this is where this question came from. I would throw out all mathematics textbooks all the way through high school, and they'd learn one thing, and that's how to count, for one thing, and then Euclid. Okay, just learn those so you learn the depth of the beauty of mathematics. But you're going to have trouble in regard to very well-done science books. It's going to be very difficult. Most of history telling is contaminated. It's just badly done. But that doesn't mean you can wave a wand and it's there. And so what we have a need for is, and this is in one way what we wanted the human life studies or want it to be, is to you need the equivalent of a deep research think tank that works in all these areas and can identify existing things that are helpful and do more research and bring them into, okay, now we finally have the biology textbook. And it won't make people laugh because it will use the most advanced biology. Okay, the same thing would be true for astronomy. The same thing would be true for physics and so on. You have to retake all the areas, not by denying them. That is, you don't become a non-reductionist chemist by denying that the periodic table exists. One thing, you wouldn't buy one of my favorite books, which I wrote about the mystery of the periodic table. So you don't do that. What you do is say, do you understand the thing that you say you understand? And so it takes quite a bit of work. And, you know, if that's sort of off-putting because we're in an instant culture, it took like 3 or 4 centuries to screw it up. Again, you aren't going to just change it in a little bit of time. So you have to dedicate time and resources because that's what the other side did. I mean, dedicated time and resources. If you look at the histories of the history of the university, you can see how this occurred, by the way. So that's one of the other things that it's important. Do you understand the history of education? Rousseau actually came crashing into that, by the way. So the answer is, I'm sorry, you don't have any alternatives at all.
200 years from now, if we start now, today, we all say today's the day. We're starting for the next 300 years to change education.
There you go.
All right, so now the final question, and then, as I said, I will ask the others of Benjamin on my radio program. How does the Epicurean understand the morality and immorality of war? Do they see some wars as just and others as unjust?
Oh, yeah, you have a rival view of morality. That is, for an Epicurean, the only source of good and evil is what happens to cause a particular person pain or pleasure, and so they define it individually. The question how you deal with laws is, you ask, I'll do the most liberal reading of it, you ask that the government protects everyone's particular desires. They're going to be renamed rights, but they're really only desires, and that's what the government does. So what you will do is create laws that keep people who have different desires from impeding each other. And that's all you can do. And that's actually so justice means allowing everyone to do whatever he wants as long as he doesn't harm anyone else. That's the Hobbesian account of justice, which actually controls the law schools. By the way, you have to take over the law schools. There doesn't exist a law school that now understands the depth of the problem. I'm not excluding any law school from that, which is going to get me in trouble. Okay. I mean, I'm already in enough trouble, so why the heck throw it all in?
We're all in trouble. So thank you so much, Dr. Benjamin Weicker. Amazing, amazing. Thank you.